Hi everyone. Before we get started today, I want to talk to you about our newest partner, BetterHelp. Throughout my own grieving process, I have found therapy to be critical in getting me to the point where I am today, and I truly cannot imagine getting through this past year without it. A lot of the world is still in some sort of quarantine or phased opening, and BetterHelp is a perfect platform for accessing therapy during this time because you can do it from wherever you are. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with a licensed professional therapist, and you can have your first session scheduled in as little as 24 hours, which is huge. I know for a lot of people, you hit a roadblock in starting therapy because there's a pressure to really find the right fit. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches. It's really easy to change a counselor if you feel like you want a better fit. The therapist you're matched with is available weekly, but you can send messages anytime through the app and get responses between sessions, which makes such a big difference, especially when you are processing a loss. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline therapy, and they also have financial aid available, which I love and is one of the reasons that I decided to partner with them. We have a special offer for the Grief Coach listeners where you'll get 10% off your first month at trybetterhelp.com/thegriefcoach. That's trybetterhelp.com/thegriefcoach. You can join over 500,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of experienced professionals. Investing in yourself is so important. If you've listened to any of the previous episodes, you know how much I prioritize doing the work to get through the grief process, and BetterHelp is a wonderful platform to leverage to do so. Go to trybetterhelp.com/thegriefcoach to get started. Hi everyone, this is Brooke James. Welcome to the Grief Coach. If this is your first time listening, I'm so glad you're here. And if you've listened before, welcome back. Today we have Katrina Ubell, who is a life and weight loss coach. She's a podcaster, and she has a grief story that I think is really important to share with a lot of people. So, Katrina, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Brooke. I'm so glad to be here because I love
Me
talking
too.
grief.
I do too. It's so important. And I feel like we are in a slowly growing minority of people who realize how important it is to talk about
Yes.
this. If you could introduce yourself, tell us who you are, tell your grief story, and then we'll get into the discussion today.
Okay. All right. Yeah, absolutely. So, I'm Katrina. I am 44 years old. So you kind of know where I'm at in my life. I have three kids who are 7, 9, and 14. And the reason we have a gap in there between the 14-year-old and the 9-year-old is because I had a full-term stillborn baby in between there. So this is always the question with infant loss is like, well, how many kids do you have? Well, living or total? What do you want to say? Right? It's
Right.
always an evolving answer and depends on who you're talking to. I'm a pediatrician by training, and I worked as one for 10 years. And it was during that time that my daughter was born dead. And then over the course of a number of years, I ended up actually leaving my practice, and now I help women physicians to lose weight through life coaching. So that's what I do. What ended up happening for us was that, I married my husband. We always thought we'd have a family, and it wasn't super easy for us to have our first child. Like, it took a while, but conceived him naturally. That was great. And I thought, you know what, let's just go ahead and try to have another baby, get the show on the road here. And I didn't get pregnant, and we didn't know why. And it was something that I always had thought to myself, I'll never do like the fertility treatments and stuff. Like, that's just, if you can't get pregnant, you can't get pregnant. This is, pre-having children, me thinking
Right,
this,
right.
like never say never, right? I was like, oh, I'd never do that. And so at a certain point, I think we had maybe been trying 2 years, maybe a little longer. And I thought, maybe I really should see someone. Maybe there's just something simple to fix. Like, maybe it's not that big of a deal. And that was, of course, the start of the slippery slope. And it did turn out that I actually had like this weird kind of pituitary tumor that was secreting too much prolactin, which made it harder to get pregnant. So we treated that and then didn't get pregnant. It was just this ongoing, like, let's try this, let's try that. Finally went to see a fertility specialist, and he told us that our chances of conceiving naturally, just based on the history, were 1-2%. And we're, oh, okay, well, that stinks. So, okay, well, what do you got for us? And so it was just, I just want to talk about, because there's also a grief process even in just not being able to conceive naturally. We had no real diagnosis. They kept saying it was just unexplained infertility. And so there's just that element of it too. We went through several rounds of insemination that didn't work. It was a very, very stressful time because I didn't want to share what we were going through with anybody. And of course I had to leave midday in the middle of my clinic to go do these things. So I made up these elaborate lies about what was going on. It was just very, very stressful. So that didn't work either. And so they were saying, okay, in vitro is the next thing. And I was, you know, I don't know. I just don't know. And I didn't really like the office, the practice that much anyway. So I went to get a second opinion, and I actually really liked the other doctor. And he's like, yeah, I think, you know, your chances are actually pretty good. It's like 50-50, which for in vitro is amazing odds. And I was, okay, well, let's give it a try. Of course, we had no insurance coverage for this or anything. Got pregnant on the first try, which was amazing. We were, oh my gosh, like I can't, like literally, I couldn't even believe it. I was so happy. And then when I was 6 weeks pregnant, I actually ended up having an ovarian torsion. So I had to have emergency abdominal surgery. So when
an ovarian torsion?
Oh yeah. So when they do the, I'll explain, when they do the stimulation to get all your eggs out for in vitro, the ovaries get like really big because they're, you know, cranking out tons of eggs. And so they're still big for a while. It takes several months for them to calm down to their normal size because you've been pumping yourself full of all these hormones. And so the way, if you think of the anatomy of the ovary, which I'll remind you about, is that it's kind of this oval shaped ball that is on the end of just kind of a pedicle of vesicle. It's kind of like hanging out there in the breeze, so to speak. And so because of those vessels just kind of hanging, like it's just sort of hanging there, when it gets really big, it can actually twist on itself. And that's what an ovarian torsion is. And that means that the blood flow then is cut off. So it's basically dying. So I was literally in the middle of my clinic seeing a patient when it happened. I didn't know that's what was going on, but it was like, I felt like I was going to maybe pass out. My ears were ringing and I felt super hot. I didn't know what was going on. I mean, within 3 hours, I was in an operating room getting it, you know, they were able to save it, which was amazing. And I thought, there's no way this pregnancy is going to survive 6 weeks. I had to get, you know, general anesthesia. They were like right in there where the uterus is. Pregnancy made it. It was a total miracle. And we were so excited. So then the rest of the pregnancy was really unremarkable. And what ended up happening was, like, toward the end, I had been overdue with my son, my first child. And so I just didn't really think anything of it. And my doctor was like out of town at a wedding for a little while. And I just was, you know, it's fine. I don't need to be induced early. I'll just wait till he gets back, because I really liked him. And so people were like, why are you still pregnant? Why are you still here? And I just think everything's fine. I really did feel like gut feeling, like the safest place for her is in my belly. And so then what ended up happening, I just want to toss a couple of these things in because this will be relevant. So I was due end of March, April started rolling around. So then it was April 1st, they offered me an induction date, but the doctor said, well, you know why nobody wants that? You know why that's available? Because nobody wants an April Fool's baby. And in my mind, because again, I'm going with everything, the baby's safer in my belly. I'm like, oh, well, if nobody wants that, then I don't either. Mm-hmm. And so didn't think anything of it, right? So that was, I think, Wednesday, if I remember correctly. So then we were like, well, they're like, no, we don't have any room for inductions on Thursday. And Friday, we can't do it because it was Good Friday. It was Easter weekend. Mm-hmm. And I live in Wisconsin, and people are generally pretty religious here. Holy Week's like a big deal. And so like everything like sort of shuts down for that. And so they're like, so we can't induce like over the weekend, no scheduled induction. So we'll just put you on the schedule for the 5th. So which would be that Monday.
Yeah.
And then we'll have the baby after that. All right. If that's what we have to do, that's fine. Well, so what ended up happening was I went to labor on my own late Sunday night, Saturday night. So leading into Sunday morning, Easter morning. And so I hadn't gotten to labor on my own before because I'd been induced. And I was like, nope, this is labor. I knew all about this. And so I labored all night at home, and probably around 3:30 in the morning, I remember just being like, you know, have I really felt her move in a while? And I was like, oh, I don't know. And so I kind of like mashed on my belly, but I didn't feel her move. But I was like, you know what? Like, she's getting squished like crazy. Like, my contractions were really frequent, but they weren't long. So I'm just thinking, like, she's just like being mashed in there. I didn't remember my son moving when I was in labor either. I just like didn't even think of it. So early in the next morning, it was, you know, 6:37 in the morning. It was like clear. Okay, it's time. This is the real deal. Now I need to go in. So we went to the hospital. I literally had zero idea that anything was wrong. Zero, zero, zero idea. Mm-hmm. Walk in. They're like, yep, you're in labor, getting me all hooked up. Can we take the, you know, the last picture of me with the pregnant belly? And they go to try to hook up the monitors as they do to just, you know, get you all situated. And they couldn't get them. They couldn't find the heartbeat. And I was like, because I was in so much pain in the full throes of labor that I still didn't think that anything was wrong. My husband said that he started getting worried. I wasn't. I was just like, oh my God, could you guys seriously get the show on the road so I can get an epidural? That's where my mind was at. I was like, what is wrong with these nurses that they can't find this baby's heartbeat? I should say that it had been a couple doctor's visits. They had sometimes had a hard time finding her heartbeat, and then they found her and she was fine.
So
exactly. So I was just, oh my God, this again, seriously. So then they're like, okay, we need to get the doctor in here. Like, resident comes in, can't get it. I'm like, what is wrong with them? So like, okay, we got to get the ultrasound. Still, I had no clue. They're like, ultrasounding. They're like, we'll be right back. Still no clue. Okay. Like, this is how powerful our brains are. Wow. And then they bring in the attending, the boss physician, to basically confirm. And I remember it so clearly. The boss physician says to the resident, go ahead. And then she told me there's no heartbeat. And I literally, that was like the first time it even crossed my mind.
Right.
I had literally no hunch, no gut instinct that anything was wrong, nothing at all. And it was, of course, like super, super devastating. And here I am in labor. And so I'm like, okay, right? Because like I'm crying, but then also huffing about, like, you can't really cry when you're like trying to breathe through a contraction at the same time, you know? And so then I'm like, what do we do? And they're like, well, we have a baby. And I was like, okay, well, can I get an epidural then? Because I can't even think right now. And so, you know, of course they came in and everyone's got the super sad face, which is not what you want. You know, everyone's like, oh, and you're like, oh my God, just put the needle in my back. I need something right now, you know? So I ended up having the baby a couple hours later. And so they can tell based on what the baby looks like, how long the baby's been dead, because I mean, not to be super gross, but it starts to decompose, right? I mean, that's just what happens. Yeah. And she had been dead like hours. So she had died while I was in labor.
Wow.
So had I been induced, maybe they would have caught that there was a problem and like done a C-section or, you know, whatever. Had I induced on April 1st, like and had an April Fool's baby, right? Maybe they would have caught all that stuff. So that's all work that I had to do afterward in blaming myself. Why didn't I? Who cares what the date of the, you know, birth date is? Who cares at all? But yeah, that was my first real grief experience. So I had one living grandparent. She lived overseas and she died right as I turned 7. I did have a little bit of a relationship with her, but not really that much. I didn't go to the funeral. It just wasn't something. We have a small family, and my immediate family is the only family that lives in America. We just didn't have a lot of family members who passed away, didn't have any friends who had died or anything like that. So I really didn't know what to do. I literally had no idea how to support myself. I remember thinking to myself, I don't want to screw this up, which is very perfectionistic, right?
Similar, I think, brain maps that we both have.
To figure out the right way to do this, in quotes, right way. And so I literally bought every book on infant loss that Amazon had. And I went back and like scoured again. I went back to, you know, the third search page, fourth, fifth search pages. Maybe there's something else hiding in here. But I like literally looked at grieving as my job, because also I was on maternity leave, medical leave. They called it medical leave, which is like, everything felt like insult to injury. You know, here I was like 45 pounds overweight and no baby. You know, I had been like, oh, who cares? I had all the M&Ms in the world. I'm like, I'll just lose it when I breastfeed. You know, your milk comes in, your body wants to feed this baby and the baby's dead. It was just so hard. And what's especially hard is everybody knew I was pregnant. Right. It's not like this was like a personal thing that we kind of can keep from other people.
Well, you also can't hide 9 months of a pregnancy.
Totally.
So how did you deal with that? Because people, I'm sure, so well-meaning, were asking you questions.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
And after a traumatic experience, regardless of what it is, you don't necessarily want to share it with people right away. So I'm sure you weren't calling up everyone you knew after the fact because you were so devastated.
Yeah.
So
I couldn't even say it out loud. I literally couldn't even bring the words to my lips without breaking down and crying.
So how did you handle that?
Yeah. I mean, luckily people kind of spread the word. So we told just like a couple of, you know, key people, and they really helped to spread the word. One of my biggest concerns was all my patients. So as a practicing pediatrician, I had literally hundreds of patients who knew that I was going to be having a baby, and they were all excited about it. The idea of going back to work and then having to tell people that person after person, visit after visit after visit, oh, my baby died. And then like their whole reaction, it was so hard. So what I ended up actually doing, to be honest, was I hid in my house at first. I didn't want to go anywhere. I had actually seen a therapist a couple of times during the infertility struggle that just to help me with that. And so I got in to see her, I think 2 days after I went home from the hospital, I was in her office. I needed to talk to somebody that could hold space for me and hold it together, that wasn't as equally devastated as every single other person in my whole entire life. I needed someone who could just hold it together and listen to me. And I mean, I don't know that she did a lot of therapy on me except to just like be there as a kind of neutral person. My OB was really concerned that I would have some issues with postpartum depression. I don't have a history of depression, but just with, I guess, you know, the chances of this, of that happening are much higher in this case. So luckily we have a psychiatrist who's like in this area, who's really like, her specialty is perinatal depression, postpartum loss, stuff like that. So I saw her a couple of times. She was actually really great because she said to me, "You're normal. Like, this is normal. You're grieving. Like, everything you're going through is normal," which made me feel a lot better because my doctor had basically forced me to take a prescription for antidepressants when I left the hospital. I was like, "Can I just see how I do?" And he was like, "What, I think you might need it." I'm like, "Let me just wait and see." And the psychiatrist is like, "You do not need that." It's like, okay.
Oh my God.
I mean, I totally would have taken it if I needed it, but I was like, "I think it's normal to be sad after your baby dies. Like, I'm pretty sure, you know." So then the therapist actually really encouraged me. She's like, "You got to stop hiding. You've got to get out and like live your life." So I live literally a half a block from my office. So I knew everywhere I went, I would see people. So then I first started with like, you know, going to Target, but either super late at night or the minute they opened. And then I would see people I knew and I'd duck around the aisles and stuff. I literally was like this whole mission to like not see anybody. She just encouraged me like, okay, you should go back to church, which was like very emotional because it was like, had been Easter, and then I was all this like post Easter stuff. And like, it just was very hard. She really encouraged me to do that. So then I found that a lot of people did know what happened. The few people who didn't, like when I went back to the office, back to my practice, like we had this whole system of telling people, and every now and then it kind of fell through and someone would be like, "Oh, how's the baby?" And I would just be like, "Oh, you know, sadly she passed away." And then it was so fascinating how it always turned into their own, you could watch their shame fest happening on their face. I would just like go right back to them and their kid and talking about whatever. And like, you could see it in their eyes. They couldn't even hear me. They couldn't even listen because they felt so bad about it.
So I want to pick up on a few things here. So one of you said like your doctor didn't even know and was like, "Take the antidepressants," and like this shame that people went through when they realized that they had said something wrong. And I think with me, most people knew my dad was sick. My dad was 75, of course, devastated me, our family, but not the same as losing a baby.
It's a different expectation, right? When someone who's 75 dies, like you're still totally sad and you wish they were around longer, but it's not shocking.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's really interesting of how people talk to you and what do they say. And as the bereaved, I had this experience and it sounds like you did too. And I would love to dig a little deeper into this. You almost are trying to make someone else feel better who's trying to comfort you because they don't know what to say. And so if you can talk about any experience with that.
There's just so many platitudes that people say. And I, you know, it is hard to know what to say. 100% hard to know what to say.
Like, that's why I started the podcast, because no one knows how to talk about this.
Nobody knows what to say. And so what people say is a thought that makes them feel better about the circumstance that you're going through, right? Because mm-hmm. they're sad too, or maybe they're sad about what happened to you, or maybe they're just sad that you're sad.
And they don't want to make you feel bad.
Right, exactly. And in their effort to not make you feel bad, it often makes you feel worse.
Yeah. Or they don't know, they don't say anything and don't know.
Right. Or that, yeah, exactly. They just pretend like it didn't happen, which is then it's like the elephant in the room. Everybody knows. So I had different people said different things. At the memorial service that we had, people said things like, you guys are young, you can have another one. That was particularly hurtful because I didn't want another baby. I wanted my baby. I didn't know when I went back to my practice and saw all these other babies because I saw babies all day long at work, right? Yeah. So then it had to be in my face all the time. And I wondered how hard that would be. I found that I didn't have any anger toward that. I didn't want this person's baby. I wanted my baby. Mm-hmm. My anger was toward the pregnant women. Because I felt like they had this blissful, in my mind, blissful experience that they didn't even know what could really happen. And I just wanted a do-over so badly. And of course, we didn't know if that could happen, right? Because we had the fertility stuff. We didn't know what would happen. So we had that. People would say, God must have needed another angel, which that one was just...
I hate that one.
I was just the logical part of me, I was just God doesn't want babies to die. I don't think that that's how this works in my mind. I'm like, that's great that makes you feel better. But I was just like, oh yeah. I mean, so I'd have to pretend, I'd have to act oh yeah. That's super helpful to me. And then it was almost a reframe immediately in my brain. That's total crap. No, the classic, right? Everything happens for a reason. No. Can I swear? I don't know.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I'm shit happens and bad shit happens to good people sometimes. And that's what happened here. Mm-hmm. We were the one in 1,000. It's just every now and then you strike the lottery in the wrong way, not because there's some predestined kind of way that life is going to pan out. Yeah. It was just things that were just so hard to stomach. And like you said, I'm trying to make them feel better now. Oh, it's okay. I mean, it's not okay, but can we just move on with the task at hand, which, at a memorial service, it's appropriate to discuss it. But when you're at work, it's just harder. And so I found, I even had patients, families that left me. They didn't want me to be their doctor anymore because they were too uncomfortable seeing me with their baby. And it was, I mean, now I can see it. That was all about them and their, it had nothing to do with me, but it really, really hurt. I remember literally crying at my desk in the office, when I found out why, people
were leaving.
And I was just are you kidding me right now? This is so painful.
And I want to talk about your career transition in a few minutes, but if we could, was there anything people said that was helpful? Because I find that the people who had lost a parent were I know nothing I can say will make this better. I'm here for you. When I meet someone or people write me emails, I'll be I'm really sorry we're in this shitty club together.
Exactly.
And when friends lose people, family, it's I'm here for you. But most people don't know what to say and don't get the nuance of how changing a few words makes a really big difference to the bereaved. So if you could share with the audience things that were particularly helpful.
Yeah. There are, two things I can think of that were that two different people did that were so amazing. One of the women that I worked with, another doctor, she just asked if she could come over and I said yes. I hadn't really talked to her yet since it all happened. And we didn't really know each other that well yet, but she came over and she had just brought some food from a deli. So it was already I didn't have to return any pans. You could freeze it if you want to, it was just some soup, just easy stuff, healthy, easy mm-hmm. stuff. Nothing that would make my life any harder, no dishes to do or returning utensils or anything like that. And she just gave me the biggest bear hug, just such a tight, tight squeeze. And then she was just I just don't even know what to say. And now that I'm telling you the story, her dad had passed away probably 10 years prior. That's probably how she knew how to do that. I just put that together now, but I still get a little teary just even thinking about it. I just felt so supported. And yes, there's literally no words right now. There's mm-hmm. nothing to say. Don't try to make it better. just be here with me in this pain. And because when people are trying to make it better, they're like, hey, I've like dipped my toe in your pain and that's icky. And I don't want to feel that. I really just want to feel better. I want to feel better about you. I want to make sure you're okay so that I can feel better and move on with my life.
Completely.
And
that,
right. And what really we need is someone to go, you know what? I am here in the manure with you for as long as we need to be here. Mm-hmm. And that's just what we're going to do. And I'm right here with you. We talked for the next like hour and a half. I told her the whole story and she just like was so dialed in and listening. Like she wasn't checking her phone or checking her watch or I got to get out of here. Like it was so clear that she was there for me for as long as this conversation organically happened.
Yeah.
And just really, really was there yet held herself together. Like, did she get teary as we talked about it? She did, but it didn't turn into her show. And comfort her. Exactly. She was more empathizing. It was like appropriate emotion in that way, which was like, it was so amazing. It really helped, made me feel like so much more connected to her. She's like a person I can reach out to. She's like a safe person I can discuss this kind of stuff with, because anybody else who tried to gloss over it or make it a little better, I was, they're not someone I can go to because I'm not seen as okay to them. I can't really be who I am right now. I have to manufacture myself. The other thing I want to mention is there's actually a family I'd taken care of their child. And they had mentioned to me like right when they had their first child, oh, we had a baby that died, you know, before this one, just want to let you know. And I was, oh, okay. And like, didn't really even give it any, you know, other thought, but at our memorial service, she came. And I was like, oh, that's so nice. I knew her from like a professional level, but I didn't really know her. Well, you know, they have like a thing for cards and stuff. So she had actually put a card in there. And I think it was like 3 pages, single space typed of like her experience having lost a baby and just all the things, I think it'd been like 6 years, like all the things that they had done to memorialize her and to keep her memory alive. And not like, hey, you should do these things, but I just wanted to share with you the things that we've done that are really special to us in case any of this might be useful for you. And it was
so
amazing.
Helpful.
Oh my God. Yeah. I read it. I like studied those pages. I was like, that's such a good idea. It gave me like a little bit of hope. Like, oh my gosh, that would be cool. We could do that too. Like that would be a really neat thing to do. And then my brain started going, we still are always on our local NPR station. We're always like a day sponsor on her birthday. And like, we still do, I mean, 10 years later, we still do that. And there's little things that we do to keep her memory alive. I found that to be so, so thoughtful of her to just be like, hey, and then she was totally just like, reach out to me. Here's my email. Here's my phone. If you want to reach out, great. She left the ball in my court and we ended up like connecting and she was a really great resource for me in so many ways.
I love that because it's something that when it's happening to you, grief, at least when it happened to me, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but like having someone be like, these are nice things to do. Cause your brain is so overloaded with emotion that you can't even like think. And then like the worst is when however many weeks, months later, you're like, oh, it would have been really nice to do that.
Yeah.
And so having kind of like a grief blueprint, for lack of a better term, is so helpful. And again, part of the reason why I started the podcast and want to talk about this and like why we connected, I think, so quickly once we started talking, because we see the value in sharing stories so other people feel less lost.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I felt so alone. Like I felt like I was the only person this had ever happened to, except it's not the case at all. This happens all of the time.
But people don't talk about their feelings because we don't want to make other people uncomfortable.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I need people who've been through this to show me that you can get through this in one piece. Everything I read was, you know, the chances of your marriage collapsing are really high and the chances of you gaining weight or becoming an alcoholic are really high. Well, this is great. Let's just add
can't
more.
Wait. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
I already struggled with my weight up and down. Yeah. This is the last thing I need, you know.
So let's talk about, because both of us changed careers after our losses. And so if you could talk about how the loss gave you new perspective, because I think a lot of people after experiencing a loss get this shift in perspective, and this is pretty common.
I mean, it was like 5 years later that I left. Okay. So it was definitely not like a quick thing at all. Cause I think part of it is when you're a doctor, like most people think like, I'm going to be a doctor my whole career. It didn't really occur to me to do anything else. And, you know, I worked through it and that was okay. What I think the way I think it led me to shifting careers was the introspective approach. I mean, it's not like I took being a mother lightly, but I developed this whole new sense of purpose as a mother, as a parent, just going, you can't just take this for granted. This is a really big deal that you have a kid. You might want to be a little more intentional about, you know, how you're raising him and things like that. Then I had two more kids and it was just kind of like, I mean, to a certain extent, it was like, wow, you know, my family is important to me. And I'm noticing I come home and I'm super wiped out and I could feel like I'm a zombie and I'm not really there for my family the way I'd like to be. But the reason, one of the biggest reasons why that was a problem for me was because I understood the fragility, right? Because, you know, a big thing that I've since worked on considerably, but kept coming up for me was like, I can't lose another child. And I kept thinking like, well, if one of my other kids died and I was just not really present and connected with them, that would be so awful that I want to be more active. And I kept thinking like, I just need like better systems and I just need like more help or things like that. And then I just started realizing like, you know, maybe it's actually this job. Maybe this is just not the right fit. And at first it was like the actual placement, like the place where I was working, where I was, well, you know, what are my other options? And I was thinking about that. And it was literally, I mean, this sounds so cliche, but it was literally in the middle of the night, like 2 a.m. I was really, really mad about something that had happened with my boss and I couldn't sleep, which is very unlike me. And my husband's like snoring next to me. And I without even knowing what I was doing, I started coaching myself. Okay. So if you're going to be this mad about it, what are all of your options? Just think of every single possible option that you have. So it's this, that, the other thing. And then all of a sudden it was the thought just popped in my head, or you could retire early. It was almost like, wait, who said that? Where'd that come from? What? Doctors don't do that. And so I got to sleep that night thinking, you know what? I'll practice another 10 years, 20 year practice. Like that's respectable. And so the next morning I told my husband, he was, oh, okay. All right. Yeah, we could do that. And then once I opened that door though, within 2 weeks, it was, I'm leaving in 6 months. And I didn't, at that time, I still didn't even really know what I wanted to do. I just knew that there was something more. And I had experienced some life coaching about a year and a half prior. And I thought it was really great. I definitely wanted to learn more about it and, you know, just teach myself more and for my kids and stuff. Cause I was like, how did I live my whole life and not know these things, you know? And then it was during the 6 months after I had given my notice when I was, you know, waiting to finish out my time there that I was, oh, that's right. I wanted to be a life coach. And really became so connected with that idea. Never wanted to have my own business, but then was just like, I guess I could try it. I felt this additional passion for helping people. I sometimes felt like in medical practice, it was so rote and it wasn't really what I thought. It was what the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends. This was, I can actually really help someone to improve their life, to really actually change their whole life for the better. Because the weight loss is just like what we focus, you know, we yes, you lose weight, but the reason you lose weight is because we work on all the other issues in your life. And so it just became this new passion. And I had all the flexibility that I wanted to be able to be around for my kids so much more. And it just kind of developed, as I think sometimes the best things do, right? It just this seems like a good idea. Let me see if I can make this work. And then it just became something that was really fun. And in the process, then this is the coolest part, in the process of being coached then a lot myself, I've worked on a lot of the final remnants of the grief process, I would say. Not to say that I'm totally done, because there's probably more, but definitely blaming myself. I had a lot of like, no, I know it wasn't my fault. I know it wasn't my fault. And a very good coach friend said to me at one point, she's, well, what if it was your fault? I instantly started sobbing. And I was like, oh, okay. Apparently there's still some more work to do there.
Yeah.
You know, like really that self-compassion, self-love, self-forgiveness. Like it's not a question of, was it my fault or not my fault? It's just regardless, can I love myself anyway? Even if I did do something that would cause the death of my baby, can I really love and accept myself anyway? And so of course, as I've done that work, I've been able to help so many of my clients with their own version of this, which I would not be able to do if I were in my medical practice at all. I love talking grief. It's like one of my favorite things. it really is such an amazing personal growth opportunity if you allow it to be, I think.
Right. And I think the thing is most people or it's really hard to allow it to be. And I think I reflect on my own, if I was working and like just had what taken like 5 days of bereavement or whatever it is, I don't think I would have gotten a chance to do that reflection, introspection that I'm still doing. But I think part of the reason I'm where I am now is because I allowed myself to go into those feelings. What I would tell listeners is just like, it's scary, but so necessary to like let yourself feel that, whether you're working with a coach, whether you're talking to like someone you love, or like journaling or whatever it is, it's so important.
And
be compassionate with yourself.
Exactly.
Sorry.
I think what's really important is recognizing that you're never going to want to do it. I would always feel like I needed to be alone and be with my grief when other people were around, like when mm-hmm. it wasn't a convenient time. So then we had a nanny who I still had come around because I'm like, well, she still needs to pay her bills. Well, you know, I'm on this medical leave. And which, by the way, you know, of course I got pressure from work then, like, well, are you going to come back early? No, I'm freaking devastated. I'm not coming back early to see a whole bunch of babies and all these people who think I just had a baby. I'm like, no, I'm not. But anyway, I'd be like, hey, could you take my, you know, could you take him and like, you know, just take him away so I can work on my grief. Inevitably, I was like feeling pretty good during that time. It was not what I wanted to do. So you just have to like plan it and just meet yourself where you're at. If you're feeling pretty good, then just write about why you're feeling good and like what your thoughts are about it and you know, what happened to you. And if you're feeling like trash, then you write about that or read something. Yeah. Just like give yourself that dedicated time to be with yourself in the grieving process, rather than thinking, you know, should be this way or should be that way or mm-hmm. something should be different right now.
There's like this false sense of security of like when you're feeling good, of like, I call them grief sneak attacks, of like just one yes. thing, someone will say something or like I'll read something and I'll just be like, oh, or like I'll be looking at pictures. I was looking at like someone in my family posted a picture that was like taken at my dad's house and I saw like the backsplash from the stove and I was, I lost it. And I was like, interesting. Okay.
It's like total kick in the stomach, right?
Like, and it's just, it's so interesting of what can set you off versus what can't. And so to just, as you said, allowing yourself to go there, no matter if you're having a hard time, a good time, whatever, just go there because it's so important. And if you put it all away in a box, then it ends up coming out at a really inopportune time.
Yeah.
I feel like.
And, you know, I think I told you this before, but I'm not a quote rememberer at all. But one of the books that I read, this one line, or is it because it's two sentences in this book and I haven't forgotten it. It's grief is patient. It will wait for you. And I was like, wow. Oh, like I didn't know that. I legit did not know that.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I get it now. Like I could gain 300 pounds trying to eat through this and all of the work will still be there. It literally will not make it go. The only way I can do this is by going through it. Mm-hmm. But it sucked so bad. I remember saying that friend who gave me that 3-page type letter, I remember being out with her one night and just being, does it get better? It was just felt like so heavy and hard for so long. And she's like, it really does. I'm like, can you tell me when though? Because I really, this is so awful. And she's, oh, I know, you know, it's just, it's natural to want to escape it.
Yeah.
You know, totally. And I think that's, and it is okay, right? To laugh and to put it down and to go, you know what? I'm going to have some fun right now. That's very healthy. You don't have to be in the throes of the horrible pain all the time, but you when it is time for that, you have to be willing to be with it so that you can work through it. And it becomes, you know, rather than like a huge massive wave over it crashing on you, it's like more like lapping at your ankles. And feels
and it's still
terrible.
There. That I like that analogy a lot. I feel like we should end there because that was very poetic, and also that you and I could probably talk for several hours. I'm so grateful that you shared all of this, and I feel like there was so much good little like nuggets of wisdom for people to take. So thank you so much for making time to do this. I really appreciate it. Do you want to tell me where they can find you online or?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, thank you for having me on. I just think it's so important for people to know that there's help and that, you know, stillbirth and infant loss, its own little flavor of grief and it affects so many people. My podcast is called Weight Loss for Busy Physicians, but I have many, 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 many non-physician listeners and you can get tons of help. And I've had people lose tons of weight just from listening to the podcast. That's something you're interested in. And then I think people can find me on Instagram at Coach Katrina Ubel MD.
Amazing. I will put both of those in the show notes. So awesome. It's easy for people to find. Wonderful. Okay, so thank you again. Thank you everyone for listening. You can find us on social at @_griefcoach. If you write a review in Apple Podcasts, it helps other people find us. So I would appreciate if you could do that. And talk to you guys soon. Thanks so much for listening.